Welcome to Regulatory Ramblings. Our podcast today is brought to you by the University of Hong Kong's RegTech Lab, HKU, and the Standard Chartered Foundation FinTech Academy, the Asia Global Institute, and the HKU edX Professional Certificate in FinTech, with support from the university's faculty of law. Our guest today is Martin James Wallace. With a rich background in the public sector and a deep understanding of financial crime, Martin brings a wealth of expertise to his current position in Singapore as the Chief Operating Officer of FinTrail. In that role, he supports the firm's efforts to provide practical and inclusive solutions in the global fight against financial crime. Before joining FinTrail, Martin enjoyed a 22-year career in the British Army's Intelligence Corps, holding various specialized intelligence and security roles in support of military operations worldwide, including being based in Northern Ireland and also at the British Embassy in Beijing. Martin holds a degree in global business management from Bournemouth University and an executive MBA from Quantic School of Business Technology. Martin is committed to supporting FinTrail's scaling and developing of capabilities. He also actively promotes collaboration and information sharing within the network to enhance collective efforts in reducing the harms caused by financial crime globally. And with that, Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, AJ. Pleasure to be here and to have this discussion today.
Much pleasure. So tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, at least that which I didn't cover. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? And what compelled you to join the Army?
I was born in Doncaster. My late father would be very proud to call me a Yorkshireman. So a lot of my time then growing up in that area, growing around the mining villages, etc. Great opportunity to get out into the woods and into the wild, and no mobile phones then. So, a great way to go and just get out, explore and do stuff. So that's sort of like my childhood and what I saw there. And then sort of as I got into my later years, a lot of my friends were 2-3 years older than me. I was an avid reader. I really, read all the, my mum managed to buy in a church sale a load of the classics, Last of the Mohicans, all that kind of stuff. So I read all those and was like really, really, really inspired by a lot of those really early readings. And like I said, my friends were 2-3 years older. So when it got to sort of later years of, trying to actually study, so I did all right at senior school and then going on to do sort of A-levels as an 18-year-old, I was a bit bored. I was playing in a band, I played drums in a band, went to university to see my friends and would spend like 2 or 3 weeks going there, sitting in lectures and stuff like that. So when I got to 18, I didn't really care that much for education or what it would give me. So ended up traveling around playing in a band and then was doing sort of a various myriad of jobs from chipping bricks, like manual labor, all the way through to sort of like managing a warehouse. And then sort of as I started to sort of settle a little bit in my early 20s, I'm like, what's this all about? What am I doing? And I was stacking boxes in a factory, working from 6 till 10 or 6 till midday, depending how that worked. And it's like I was having the same conversation every day. Great, some interesting conversation, but same conversation every day. And I thought, yeah, what? It's not an existential crisis, but what am I actually doing? What am I actually doing in the world?
What's it all about, Alfie? Same conversation with the same people who were content with their lot in life, and clearly there was something restless in you.
Yeah,
because that was I'm gathering that wasn't enough.
No, it wasn't. So my brother was already in the army. He was in the Royal Green Jackets, and I tried a couple of other sort of establishment roles, but didn't really get around and tried to other jobs. And then eventually it's like, well, at 24, why don't I go and join the army? I was very fortunate that the job that I had allowed me time to train and physically prepare for it. But that was not a problem. And then when I went to go and join, it's like, well, what do you want to do? It's like, I've got no idea what can give me something that I can take beyond being in the army. And actually, the recruitment sergeant was the same regiment as my brother. And he's like, well, why don't you join the Green Jacket? And it's like, well, yeah, I could, but what else is out there? So things like signals, telecommunications, IT, and that kind of thing. It's like, well, that's probably future-proof. And then he's like, oh, there's this intelligence corps thing. I'm not really sure what they do, but yeah, that might be interesting. And it's like, oh, okay, you know, let's have a look at that. So I was very fortunate that usually it takes quite a long time to join, but because the intelligence corps was moving at that time, their location, the headquarter locations, ended up doing like the entrance to the army tests and then entrance to the intelligence corps tests, like within a couple of weeks. So I joined within a couple of months. But yeah, when I started speaking to somebody that is actually in there and telling me about it, it's like, that sounds interesting. And as a more sort of sanguine approach, I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose, have I? You know, I'll stay in it while it's interesting. And if it's not interesting, I've got options, I've got choices. And yeah, 22 years later, I'm like, yeah, that was a really good ride. It was interesting for the whole period. So yeah, I came out of that been traveled the world, seen lots of different places. I've met my wife and yeah, you know, taking my two children along with me on that journey. And it's led me then now to being here in Southeast Asia where I currently sit. I would have never been here in Singapore had I have not worked in Beijing for that period of time and you know, experienced what this, you know, this environment has to offer.
Well, there's that saying, people attribute it to Woody Allen, but I think George Bernard Shaw said it first. Life is what happens while you're making other plans. One doesn't know where one juncture of their life will lead to the next step.
Yeah, and I think going back to that sort of education piece is that I knew as I was getting to my later years in the art, so Beijing was my second to last tour. And during that time, it's like, well, I know I'm going to be leaving in 5 years' time. What the hell will I be doing? And thought, well, I'm going to go out into the business world. So that's then when I did actually do my degree. I did it at 42 years old, sat down and did three years of global business management because I need to understand the lexicon of business, understand how it all works. You know, I've got an understanding as a layman, but I thought if I'm going to go into that environment, I need to know a little bit more. So that was part of the plan was to get to Singapore. I think it's Mike Tyson that says, isn't it? It's great to have a plan. A plan works until you punch it in the face or something like that. But
I mean, and he knows, right? I mean, think about it, that from 85 till early 1990, he was the world heavyweight champion, was king.
Yeah.
People regarded him as the toughest man on earth. This is before the UFC. And then one night in Tokyo in early 1990, and someone by the name of James Buster Douglas pulls off the greatest upset in combat sports. And again, those types of sudden shocks that don't go according to plan, that change the trajectory of your life. Yeah. What have you learned in terms of dealing with those?
I think me as an individual, I generally try and have a bit of a guiding light, whether that be, clearly my own principles are that, but in terms of just like navigating the world, like where I want to be, what I want to do, how I want to feel. And I think working in the domain that I've worked in for 22 years is that a lot of that is dealing with uncertainty.
Very much so.
And if I then overlay that into what I do now, it's like, it's not necessarily uncertainty, although it still is quite a part of it. It's about change, because things, the constant is change. You know, I try and do things or try and create things, and there's always an iteration or a movement or the market or whatever has an impact. So I think being able to be resilient against that and know that there is going to be change, you don't know everything. There will be things that will come up and surprise you. But I think in knowing that means that when they do happen, you can have that little breath, that little moment to go, well, that wasn't quite what I was expecting. Absorb it, understand what you're then going to do about it, because you've got maybe, a certain methodology or skills or whatever, just to break that down into something that actually, rather than this big cataclysmic event, you can break it down into small component parts and then start to chip at the things that you can control within that. And then in even mentally doing that allows you to deal with, you know, those challenges or problems that surface that you weren't quite prepared for.
You know, this is a debate, though. I mean, I think in maybe, I don't know if necessarily in your field, but certainly in fields affiliated with, related to yours, crisis management, crisis containment. Some people say you can't really manage a crisis once it's happened. The best you can do is contain it. I don't know if it's a matter of semantics or minds of some people. There is, these terms do make a difference because they go to your fundamental approach to dealing with a crisis. And I imagine someone who spent time in Northern Ireland knows a thing or two about dealing with crises.
I mean, we've had clearly in our recent years a global crisis that nobody was quite prepared for. I think it was, you know, that the Black Swan or what, you know, those type of events. Yeah, I think even trying to contain it is, you're just trying to minimize
or mitigate the effects of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're just trying to mitigate it as much as you can. It's not, I don't even think there was no containment. But when it comes to sort of more practical elements or more containable elements, yeah, I think you already understand. You know, if you're doing a risk analysis, you've already got like likelihood and impact and all those kind of things that you would normally plot out, and you know, people will put on their charts or their 4x4s or their 9x9s and do all that kind of stuff. But depending on that is that, yes, you might have a framework to do that, but you've also got to have a little bit of mental agility and flexibility to make sure that you can deal with that. So certain scenarios, yes, you can plan and prep. And that's something that comes from the military. You know, you've got a certain series of scenarios that you plan and prep for, and, you know, immediate actions, drills, they're no different to any kind of risk that you're trying to manage. But I think, in doing that, you shouldn't be so rigid. And it does overlap into financial crime. You shouldn't be so rigid in that you just go by the rules and the system, because you've got to challenge that. And there are certain things that you should challenge, and certain things, clearly in the military context, you do those drills because it's threat to life and you want to have some kind of immediate reaction, but it's not an immediate blind reaction. You're taking in the environmental triggers, the situation analysis, what's happening here, what's the causes, what's the effect. But in the financial crime bit, yeah, you still need to have that, because if you just keep working through a system or a process, there's no going back to what I was saying earlier, there's no evolution of that or even just an iteration of that, because criminals are always out there thinking with this growth mindset, how can I use this to benefit me and my criminal gains? And it's the same kind of mindset that if you're dealing with risk, etc., yes, you need to deal with the threat or the element at hand. But then when you're thinking about that, you need to think about the, you know, second and third order of that and how is it going to impact others, but also how is this going to change and how does this change the dynamic of how you operate and what you're doing? So I think being very critical about, is it doing what you expect it to do, or is it creating the effect that you want it to create, is really important to have in the back of your mind whenever you're doing any of these things. Because what is the best thing ever, best thing ever today, tomorrow could be it's been exploited and it's of no value. So you've got to be quite critical.
So that military mindset of looking at the different levels of things, that there's a kinetic aspect, there's a strategic aspect, there's a tactical aspect, there's a logistical aspect, there's a political aspect. Did you bring that thinking, to what extent did you apply that thinking to what you do now in the private sector?
I think some of that is already embedded in behaviors. You know, we are creatures of habit. Yeah. And we will default to what our sort of, you know, our base operating level is. But in trying to help Fintrail scale, grow, you know, improve how it performs, etc., I'm always considering what the effect of what I'm doing is. And sometimes it's things that are just, you know, how can we just improve this just 1%? How do we make it just slightly better than it was yesterday? Because those 1% over a year, over multiple years, compound and make big improvements. But I think some of that is also trying to look at what don't we need to do? What is not adding to that 1%? You know, what is detracting from what we're doing? So we're quite a lean organization. We work to a high demand. The individuals there are all specialists. They're all experienced. They know what they're doing. So it's not for me to tell them what to do. It's for me to enable them to do it better. So looking at how we perform our products and services, they're the experts that can tell me where they might have some challenges or they might need some extra support or help in iterating or developing that. And it's my job to sort of come step back from that and like, right, how are we getting to that point? You know, how can I make people have the space and time to be able to think critically about what they're doing rather than some boring back office administration or some of the tasks that they don't need to be doing or don't need to be looking at or don't need to be monitoring. So trying to allow them the freedom to operate and move and really critically work through what they're trying to deliver and come back and iterate. That means that, I have to try and work out on all the boring back office stuff around how do I allow them the space and time to do that? Because we're only small and, you know, we're all doing multiple things at any given time.
That's how it is for the startup, right? That's the entrepreneurial approach. Everyone does everything, which is good training, certainly for later on in life. Coming back to your time with the Army, I mean, yes, your brother was in the Army, but did the fact that earlier generations of your family served is inevitably this at the time? Did that influence your decision to sign up?
I'd say consciously, no. It wasn't necessarily on the you know, why do I want to do this? But
family tradition of service.
Yeah. So unconsciously, my uncles served. They were in the Green Jackets, which is why my brother ended. My dad did serve as a territorial for a number of years, which I think some of the.
And those are basically the reserves. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah. So he was in the Special Forces Reserves, and a lot of what he brought, I think, guided me into that. But it wasn't necessarily a conscious that I felt a weight of tradition or something that I needed to carry on. Maybe that's me being selfish. I don't know. But it was more about what. As a younger man, I was quite principled. I did have, and actually, when I speak to some of my friends from that era, it's like, I'm surprised you joined the Army because, you know, at one point I had very long hair. I was playing in this rock band, traveling around. It's like, don't.
Yeah, that sounds more youth counterculture, more defiant of authority, more, you know, I mean, that how someone like that finds their way into the Army would seem to be a story in and of itself.
Yeah. Which I think leading it into the intelligence corps is actually then it's the right jigsaw piece to put where it needed to be, because that gave me the freedom really to think about the application of what I'm learning in there. Whereas when I was outside of that, it's like, well, I need it's purpose driven, but you know, I had maybe my principles driving purpose before then, but then in the military I felt there was a real purpose to what I was doing.
Not, and please don't take this pejoratively, but my sense that when I've encountered former intelligence types, either, you know, in intelligence services or in military intelligence roles, they're looking for the offbeat types. They're looking for the oddballs. They're looking for somewhat eccentric people, not just highly intelligent people, but people who can view the world differently, people who maybe aren't as conformist. And that certainly in your line of work, I'd say that's probably a strength.
I think definitely, and that definitely carries over into, you know, what I would think about people that are trying to combat financial crime as well. And that, you know,
they can think outside of the normal modalities that are pedestrian, that most people could figure out or that most people are taught.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the maybe trends that is starting to come through in some of the firms that, you know, we've worked with, is that, and equally for us, is that we're not asking for a degree education. We're trying to look at competences and how you think and view the world, just to what you were saying. So how, what's the point of having a, you know, a team of however many people that are all thinking the same way? That's not going to, you know, enhance, evolve, iterate, provide any kind of critical analysis in what you're doing, or critical analysis to the information or the data that you're trying to work through. So I think having slightly different experiences, backgrounds, you know, your education path, where you've worked, all these things add up to a very potent workforce that can really then challenge, evolve, try and make things that little bit better, because you know, both from that military context in the individuals that I've worked with, there's clearly certain criteria that needs to be met to be able to be involved in that area. But then in my role at Fintrail, and when we look at hiring and how we want to try and get the best people to come and help us, you know, provide the best service to our clients, yeah, that's something that is very much at the forefront. You know, it's banged on quite widely around diversity, but I don't just mean diversity because of the, you know, protected characteristics. I mean diversity as well from a diversity of thought and how you work out a problem, how you look at the world, what's your background, and what's the lens that you view it with, because that creates some great discussions and also, you know, provides those different perspectives that you just wouldn't get if you didn't have that in your organization.
I know. I mean, for the longest time, for example, the FBI only hired lawyers and accountants. And yes, that served the purpose of crime detection and prevention in an earlier age.
Yeah.
But then they had to open it up. It made sense to open it up to people with backgrounds in criminology and psychology and engineering and medicine. And I mean, Kroll, for the longest time, they will hire former law enforcement and intelligence types, and, you know, the spooks. But they'll also hire journalists.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, it's the same skill sets of, you know, finding information, but coming at it from vastly different perspectives. And so they claim it made for a richer environment, because often, you know, the journalists might think of things that the ex-cops or the military types wouldn't think of. In fact, about a month ago, someone who applied to one of your competitors in this space, going back to what you were saying about your interest in diversity of thought and how you think through problems, and you're not necessarily looking for a particular degree. The exam this young lady got, I mean, the questions they were asking, they had nothing to do. Well, in a roundabout tangential way, yes. Yeah. They had to do with due diligence, KYC, you know, politically exposed persons. But they wanted to know how she thought. I mean, and one of the questions was, which superpower would you rather have? Strength, flight, or the ability to be invisible?
Yeah.
And obviously there's one particular power that, well, there are two, because this sperm still has, you know, armed men with guns in its employ, which Kroll no longer has. There, I've kind of given it away. But, you know, there's one particular skill of those powers that lends itself more neatly to, you know, that particular line of work. But the fact that they're asking that type of question says to me they want to know about mindset, they want to know about attitude, priorities, and temperament as well.
Yeah. Well, I think in those kind of scenarios, there probably is no right answer. It's about how do you present a logical argument for whatever skill and its application within this given scenario. And I think taking that position, that tells you more, irrespective of whatever, you know, flight, strength, invisibility, it tells you more than actually just using that skill. It's like, how do you work in a, you know, going back to saying about uncertain, that who knows what would be best or what, but how do you articulate that? How do
you precisely? Because argument. one might say, okay, this guy's chosen strength. He values brute force. He has his role. He has his purpose. the person who chooses invisibility, okay, I can send them in for more covert clandestine type work, you know. And the guy who chooses flight, is he a coward? If you, depending on how you look at it, right? I mean, he's chosen flight, so that means he'd rather run away. Or, but flight can be very useful in, when it comes to recon, right? When it comes to surveillance. So, yeah.
So these are the really deep questions that and discussions that I have with my 15-year-old son. He's always like, oh well, if you had this, what would you do, or what would you prefer? Would you prefer to be able to fly or be invisible? And it's like, just even just having that discussion and working through like what would be, how you would use it, what you, whether it'd be good or not. It's not about the tangible, like the skill. It's about, you know, how you understand the world and how you would make it hopefully better. Or, you know, the old sort of like, if you could travel through walls, would you go and rob a bank? You know, there becomes the morality of using things like that and how you would use it as well, you know. I love those types of questions, and it's something that through Hiram we have a couple of questions around that. It's not about whether there's a right or wrong answer. It's just, can you articulate your position on this particular area? And that says more. If you can't do that, when we're in the, you know, being able to talk to clients, being able to pass information into something succinct, give them critical findings. If you can't do that thing, that's a very, and you can't do it for something in that kind of vein, then you're probably not the right person. So it's a really good exercise in being able to understand how people view and how they can work with that, you know, kind of level of data and argument, which they've never been approached or asked that before, maybe.
I'm assuming that your interest in financial crime was born during your time as a British Army intelligence officer. What was it that sparked your interest in it? Was the nature of your work evidencing to you the importance of thwarting money laundering and terrorist financing, which are not necessarily the same thing, but they are related subjects, so we tend to learn about them together?
Yeah, so there's definitely some overlap. And I think in the just sort of the broad picture, it's like, you know, how do you identify, you know, bad people doing bad things? And when I was sort of reflecting back, like, you know, and I'm going to business, what kind of things would I want to do? And the sort of one of the normal trajectories is, you know, going to security and security and risk management directly. And I thought, well, yeah, I can do that, but that's sort of, you know, a replication of some of the things that I've already been doing. So how can I sort of, and maybe what I'm doing now is a replication, but how can I sort of change that a little bit? And I thought, well, you know, I'm looking at threats, challenges, things. And actually, I did give it some thought around, like, you know, what is a, you know, problem that's not yet being solved? How might I be able to help with that? So yeah, financial crime and combating money laundering, etc., fell right into that. And I thought, yeah, that could be for me. So the way that I normally go about working out problems, so I tried a little bit. I did a little bit of training in, you know, understanding money laundering, some training in fraud, how to combat fraud. And then once I'd had that, I thought, yeah, this is probably right. And then to make sure I did have that, and then I spoke to as many people as I could that I thought were already working in that domain or were considered experts in that domain. So I thought, yeah, definitely financial crime is something that, you know, I think for me will give me some of that purpose and drive that I had within the military. Yeah. And then I was doing this, the degree, and then I started this, the MBA that I was working on. And then, you know, where I'm working now in Fintrail, an opportunity came and said, well, I always thought I would be a practitioner, like an investigator or somebody that's actually right at the front end doing that. And he's like, well, yeah, you can help with that, but why don't you come and help me build, you know, Fintrail out and help scale the company? You've got this education, you've got some good experience. Come and see what you can do. And it's like, well, great. You know, like what have I got to lose? But the opportunity there was, there's that, you know, Fintrail as an organization had a really strong purpose. I felt at joining that, you know, actually cared about the impact of financial crime on the individuals, because when you talk about money laundering and financial crime, it sort of distances it from those individuals that have already been a victim of crime and already been, you know, or even through the life cycle become victims of crime, doing money mules, etc. So making sure that we understand that this is about, although we're working numbers and processes, this is about people at the front through that life cycle at the end that are victims or vulnerable to financial crime. And then that when you think about it that way, it's a really great purpose to work towards and trying to, you know, minimize the ability for criminals to conduct their crimes, gain their money and get it into the financial system so they can be sat in their bungalows on the beach, in their yachts, you know, enjoying the spoils of illicit activity. That's sort of how, you know, bringing that together, how I decided that financial crime was something that I would like to be, or combating financial crime was something that I'd like to be involved in. And Fintrail, you know, when I was leaving the army, I was offered a great opportunity to come and help. I've been enjoying it year on year. And, you know, it's been evolving since when I first started to now, I'm now 4 years in, which, yeah, it's a great ride so far.
Which brings us to Fintrail. And I mean, in your own words, as a consultancy, what does it do and what does your role specifically as COO there entail?
Yeah, so Fintrail as an organization, we help companies manage their financial risks to financial crime and their regulatory compliance. So that means everything around financial crime from the start point. So understanding
you're in a crowded space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, your risk assessments, working it through into how you integrate tech and use those great systems to help you understand and manage some of those risks. To then at the latter end of that, assuring, auditing, making sure you're testing and everything's working as it should. And then if you get challenges or problems, coming in and helping to, I don't know, remediate, clear alerts, and all that good stuff. I think part of what we bring in that is that all our consultants, all our people that do the delivery, they're all experts, if you will. They've sat in the head of financial crime roles, head of AML in fintechs, in banks. They know the environment. They know the challenges and pains that you know, everybody is dealing with. When we try and provide our services and help people do the management of financial crime risks and all the good stuff that we provide, we also have an eye on making sure it's not only like the regulatory compliance, because that's a given, that's the base level point, but we're really looking at how can you be the most effective, whether that's using tech, whether that's a process, whether it's a, you know, a policy that you've got that people are looking at, making sure that it's actually dealing with your risks at your given time and then how you expect that to evolve. And I think that effectiveness piece, I mean, it's you know, it's not unique to us. It's clearly called out across, you know, the global financial crime landscape. But what's the point in doing something if it's not doing it at the best way that it can do it? So being able to, you know, go back to what we were saying earlier about critical thinking and having that diversity of thought and how people are reviewing that. It's not just coming in and going, oh, you know, X regulator says you should do this. It's like, well, yes, what are your risks? How do we manage that? And in doing that, we should cover the regulatory aspect, but also within your, you know, small company, medium company, large company, because we work with so many people, we know what the best practice is. We are reviewing and looking at how we can get the best value out of the systems and what you've got. You know, the mantra is doing more with less. So how do we look at what you're doing and say, actually, if you did these two or three things, you would improve how you're operating, you would get better outputs. So that's some of the real value that we bring when we come to clients. And that's sort of going back to the premise around people that we were talking about earlier, having the right people with the right skills and the right mindset means that's a very powerful mix to be able to help hopefully deliver the best value that we can when we go and speak to people. And then for my role in that as COO is when we first started, or when I first started, it was a very much a new role. And how do we mature the business? How do we make sure we've got all the right tools, the right systems, the right processes, so we can have those best people delivering their best service that we can. So quite simply, it's like an oversight of everything, but then in some areas built, so HR building that out into something that's quite competent and what people would expect. Because if you want to attract the best talent, you've actually got to give them something that is comparative. So yeah, we're not the, you know, just come and take whatever you want and you can have all this time, whatever. But we're a very attractive package, practical, trying to give value to our employees. But in that trying to give value, it's not just about, you know, the finance, the benefits and all those kind of things. It's about having, going back to what I was saying earlier, about the freedom to explore, the freedom to challenge, the freedom to sort of think about what you're doing and come to me, come to the rest of the company, go, hey, look, we're doing this, but I think there might be a slightly better way to do this. And that is the real, you know, allowing people to do that, but also selecting people that can do that. That's the real, I don't know, the goldenness of having and working in this organization is that I get to work with people that are like that. And that rubs off, you know. Yeah. you felt it in an office or somewhere, wherever you've been working. If somebody's want to a negative Nelly, I apologize for Nellies out there, but you know, like, oh, you know, there's always a problem. There's always a, yes, human nature is we're always going to complain about what's not quite right. But having people that come in and go, oh, I think there's a better way of doing this. Can we try this? Can we try that? That rubs off. It's a really powerful environment when you've got that. And yeah, you can't not then start to, when you're doing your work, it's like, oh, you know, my colleague was just like, yeah, thinking about this, maybe we can use it here. And it stimulates ideas. It stimulates that evolution that as a small organization that is in a congested marketplace, that's the kind of things that we want to make sure that we can continue to deliver these, you know, high quality, valuable services that we do.
Going back to your point about anyone can complain about the problem. Okay. It's long been said that oftentimes defining a problem accurately is more than half the battle. But here's my question to you. The people who are constantly pointing out problems, is it incumbent upon them, as a former boss of mine would say, come to me with solutions, not problems? Or a common mantra in certainly with some of my German and Swiss clients in the past was, and they would say this to their staff, okay, you've defined the problem, what's your solution? Is it incumbent upon then those that point out a problem or are constantly nagging, are they obligated then to come up with a solution, in your view, as a manager, as an exec? Or is that something you will give some thought to as a leader, or you will arrive upon it as consensus? But in the first instance, the person who points out the problem, are they obligated to come up with a solution, or at least try to?
I think you know, a self-serve solution is great. If you've identified a problem and then solve it, that's great. I think if you are doing that though, you need to communicate that, because it might be your one problem, but it could be a team-wide problem. So I think there is a thing around like notification, and then more generally, do I expect people to have a solution? No, but I expect them to be part of that solution, because they're dealing with a problem. But problem notification means, yeah, of course, it gets put into the pot. You would triage that. What's the, you know, what's the highest priority? What's the biggest impact? How do we deal with that? But equally, they're in looking at those problems and identifying them. That's part of that critical mindset. But what we don't want is that you're just looking at problems and the expectation that it's somebody else's, you've identified it, but it's somebody else's problem. Well, no, it's a problem that's clearly affecting you. So you should be part of that solution, whether that's I would find a solution and you would test it and make sure it is right.
So frontline function, what, you know, function specific responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so to take that sort of a step back is that you've got to understand why you're doing things. So I think if you understand why you're doing something, then when you're identifying those problems, then you understand what the impact is and where it is. So you get into that really, you know, a really good reporting of what it is. And if you've got, if you understand why, then you probably understand in some degrees how you might be able to solve that or what might help resolve that, that challenge that you're dealing with. So I think if you understand why, it means you understand or can help to define your problem better because you know what the output you're trying to achieve. But if you don't understand that, then you don't really understand the full aspect of the problem. So, but yes, I would expect somebody hopefully understanding why to find the problem and say, if they don't have a solution, I think maybe we ought to try X or Y. But if they've got a solution, then yeah, communicating that, and then we can test it and make sure that it does what it's meant to be doing.
I bring that up, and that's what. But I bring that up because for as long as I've known you, a recurring theme with you is continuous improvement, learning, and curiosity. And I remember Nicholas Nassim Taleb, the author of the Black Swan, pointing out that there are certain organizations, certain countries, certain systems in the world that every crisis, every problem is a learning opportunity, and that they learn from it and they feed it into their base of knowledge. And so that those mistakes don't get repeated again, as opposed to certain countries that are basket cases, certain organizations that commit the same errors again and again and again. It was said about the neocons regarding the Iraq war. They've learned nothing and they've forgotten nothing. Or the Jacobins in revolutionary France, much was said about them. The people that learn nothing and forget nothing. And so why is this so important to you? The importance of continuous learning and curiosity and the improvement aspect's clear, but
yeah,
many people feel I've gotten my credentials, I've learned on the job, which is the best learning you can get, and over time you get better. So if you've gotten your credentials and you're learning on the job, is that not enough, or do you feel even in your line of work, as with lawyers and accountants and doctors, some degree of continuing education, remedial education is still necessary?
I think we're humans and we are guided by our emotions. And when we talk about, even from a military context, you know, we try and create the historical record of where we've faced challenges. And
how you read Sun Tzu, you read Clausewitz, you read the classics on war, you know about tactics and strategy. What else is new? Even though, technology does change, but
yeah. So all of those, you know, documenting, and you would think that yes, we learn from those. Yes, we do. We do learn from those. But going back to the Mike Tyson element, either you have a plan, but it works until you get punched in the face. So going back to curiosity and that continuous learning, I think that having that kind of mindset or that approach helps you deal with the uncertainties or those unknown unknowns that you would then end up facing. So part of my learning style.
Oh, yes, the Rumsfeld.
But part of my learning style then is that I'm not somebody that would read around a problem or just read for the sake of it. And that sounds like I don't enjoy reading. I do enjoy reading, but generally I'm reading because there's an itch. There's something that I'm wanting to find out about. And think now in the digital age, it's like, I need to learn something. I need to learn a new skill or I actually did it for, a plumbing problem that I had. It's like, I've got a problem with one of the toilets. I've never done that before. How do I learn about that? So a quick, tap on the keyboard and you've already got a YouTube video or somebody's blog that's describing step-by-step how to do something. It's like, wow, it's like, it's not quite plugging into the matrix. Like I know something, but it's one thing to know, it's another one to apply that. So my learning is that, I want to know why which is the curiosity. And then when I want to know why, then I want to apply, because I'm trying to, I've either got a problem or I've got a situation that I'm trying to resolve or understand better. And so it's like that initial bit of learning and then taking it to the application. And sometimes that initial bit of learning, when you go to the application stage, it's not actually the right thing. So you actually, you're learning then in the application. And then once you've learned in the application, that becomes experience. And then, yeah, you know, you can take that to the whatever level. So I suppose as a younger man, it was more about the book or the person. Whereas as an older man now, in the age that we live, we've got the whole knowledge of the world. Clearly, you've got to refine that into what's useful and what's not, or what's maybe true and what's not. But yeah, having this digital library of knowledge for me is really, really great. And now we move into sort of having co-pilots with generative AI and things like that, which, you know, are changing that landscape. So being able to take some new knowledge and apply that has become quicker, more in depth. If you don't have the curiosity, you're not going to go to search or find those individuals or do those things, because you're just going to be happy with your lot. So taking that back to the micro is that, if you're in your role and you get a little friction, or why every time I do this, why does it do that? And then you get curious as to why. And then that's going back to the problem resolution, because you've been curious and like, why does it do that? And then you understand why. Oh, actually, yeah, if I did these 2-3 things, it would stop doing it. Okay, simple, boom, that's done. That's the initial resolution. Or if it's why, and it's like, why is it doing that? Oh, actually, this is a much bigger problem that I can't solve, or I need some assistance. Then you can take that broader and get some resolution. But if you don't question why, then have that curiosity, then you're not, maybe it's me, but you know, I don't think you're going to really learn in the right way, because you're not going to have that tangible output, because you're actually trying to resolve something that's butting against you and causing you a problem.
Well, I had a situation with the one case I was working on as a researcher. And we were dealing with one older attorney who graduated from Harvard Law in 1957. Okay, you might say that he got into Harvard suggests he's smart and he's a member of the cognitive elite. And yes, he's a respect of the bar. But some of the younger lawyers had to explain to him that there had been certain changes in the law since he went to law school. And, you know, that lack of curiosity, well, sometimes because of your seniority, because of your position, you can get away with being less than curious, because a lot of that drudgery, a lot of that legwork is delegated down to younger underlings further down the pecking order.
Yeah. But going back to what we were saying around like having the right teams, yes, you might delegate some of that, but if that person has the psychological safety to be able to go and say, hey boss, there's been a few changes, maybe we ought to do it in a slightly different way, or this is something that you need to know, and raising that rather than just my boss is out of touch now. So it's much more of a working the relationship between that. I mean, we're quite a flat organization, so it's quite easy for us, so I can understand in other organizations where it might be a bit more structured, you might not have that, but you know, it happens, but you know, in the ideal world is that you would want people that would be able to help support you. And even if for that individual, if they've got an understanding of why, then clearly they might be a bit more curious. But if you're hiring the right people to support you, because you know, there's always somebody that's smarter, has more creds, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, why would you want to hire people that are just people that are going to do it without thinking? You want to hire people that are smart and can improve the landscape. So yeah,
I think part of it's also a generational divide. And age factors into it. Younger people older people, even if the younger person's right and knows things, oftentimes it's hard, I find, for the older person. People can become hidebound with age and set in their ways. It's harder for the older person to humble themselves and listen to the younger person. I had a friend who went to college, got a bachelor's degree in agriculture, tried to bring that knowledge back to the farm. And his father was used to doing things the old, early 20th century way. And he said, share your theories and ideas with your professors. Right here, I'm the boss. and so listening to someone who's younger is oftentimes difficult. And this brings me to FinTrail. Just my perception, a lot of your staff tend to be on the younger side. And I'm just wondering, is that by design?
So I wouldn't... It's an interesting perspective because I wouldn't necessarily say it's on the younger side. I think in the way that, externally we communicate is clearly trying to understand the why, but in a way that, look, it's a really challenging topic, and we could be dour, we could be very, rigid, formatted. It's like, how do we expand this message? How do we get this message out broader? And trying to put things in maybe a slightly different lens or in a way that makes it accessible means that the messaging around, how can we help improve the landscape around combating financial crime? We want it to have the strongest message that's going out there. And, I think people that are the old and bold, I would expect that they are savvy enough to be able to see the value in what we're doing and how we're doing it. And it should be articulated that's clearly understood. But equally for those that are, coming into the industry, people that want, to have that drive, and we think about, what the resource and talent pool is like.
Young people can be arrogant too. They think they're fresh out of college. They've got all the answers, they know it all. I mean, and seeing the arc of my own career, I went through that as well. I was far more sure of things in my 20s than I am now.
Yeah. But being able to capture that and then drive it into something that actually is really meaningful is really great. It's easier to take people that are motivated, whether that's through arrogance or what you would consider maybe a negative. If they've got some drive, it's easier to channel that drive. If they've got no drive, that's really hard to stimulate because it's very much, an intrinsic element that you would need. But equally, it's those that maybe, this comes back to diversity and maybe neurodiversity, in that just because somebody might be, want to be at home or not engage with lots of people, might be a bit introverted, does it mean that they can't be a great, consultant or great person to try and work through, financial crime problems? No, it doesn't. Part of what it is as leaders and managers, I feel this very, I've worked in training elements in the military as well as doing training here at FinTrail, is that part of it is understanding your audience and how they access the information, because, you're always dealing with generalities. You're always dealing with trying to do it for the masses. And because we're a smaller organization, because we're dealing with a smaller group of people, we can do things probably more individualized. But if you don't understand how your individuals view the world or how they approach that, some of that is that they can tell you that, but you've got to be aware. So an example is that I was doing some training for some specialist skill sets. And it was a bit of a badge of honor that only 30% of people passed. And when I turned up, it's like, so all those 30%ers are all like, aren't we so cool? And I'm like, that's not good. Why can't we get this up to 40%, 50%, 60%? So some of what I then looked at was like, well, who are the people that aren't getting there? And can we do something before they turn up so they're at least better able to access what we're delivering? Are we delivering too much in too little time? But equally, those individuals that are there, the way that we're doing instruction, so it, theoretical to practical, can we do like a stepping stone in that that covers the theory in the classroom, but add some practical on top of that, so that the transition is not so stark between it? Yeah, and you start doing things like that, guess what? The pass rate starts to go up. And yeah, does the honor of like being one of those 30%ers diminish? Well, no, because it's a great job and a great skill set that people were deploying. But, you know, it's that kind of mindset, I think, that you don't have to be like that. You know, so knowing that maybe that, so even if you had like 80%, doing it for 80%, that 20%, why would you not want to try and still cater for that?
You think about ACAMS, okay? For the longest time, they didn't, go back to 2006 when I first came back to Hong Kong. They didn't have, they had maybe 20 people, I think, at that time. Well, no more than 40 that were ACAMS accredited in Hong Kong. More people started taking the test. They started doing well. More people got the accreditation. Then they started making the exam difficult. That didn't work. Then ACAMS introduced another criteria, another exam you could take, which is the ACAMS audit credential. You know, the real special forces of the, you know, financial crime world. That can go on forever. I mean, I agree, knowledge and intellect and ability without drive, you know, give you an amount of nothing. And certainly what I was told a long time ago was, humble yourself. You know, there's always something to learn, even from those that are obnoxious and get on your nerves. And as far as the generational gap that I pointed to, I think sometimes if the older person says, okay, this person's younger than me, I have to talk down to them. I have to talk to them in a way that they're a subordinate. That in and of itself creates the standoffishness, the diffidence, the quote-unquote generation gap, and that makes it harder for generations to relate to each other and work together, as opposed to if you're willing to humble yourself and say, this young person, I believe I have something to impart, and this young person has something to teach me, then that causes everyone's ability and everyone's game to raise in the organization. Which nicely enough comes to my next quick question, which was, you know, you talk a lot about working with high performing teams, working with the best people you can find in the business, but that brings both pros and cons, right? Because you have to deal with the egos, the type A personalities, and that's not age specific. By the same token, high performers force you to raise your own game. What are your thoughts on that? Do you concur or do you?
You know,
what have you seen as a manager?
Yeah, I think over my career so far on the different roles and areas where I've worked, there's always been the person that, you know, nobody likes, that always asks the questions, finds out your little flaws and cracks and all that kind of stuff. And I suppose going back to, you know, humans, emotions, that doesn't feel nice. But I think this is something that I've learned as well through business, is that there's business and there's people. Just because you're doing the business stuff of like maybe pointing out those flaws and cracks doesn't mean you have to be a dick doing it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, some people do, you know, I don't care how it makes you feel. I'm trying to make this better. And it's like, well, yes, but imagine how much better it would be if you just thought a little bit about how it would feel and maybe framed it slightly. I haven't got time for that. Okay, great. But, you know, if your actions, the way you deliver things, they always have an impact. And what impact are you trying to create? Are you trying to create an impact that will then improve, will change behaviors, move things on? Yes. Okay, well, maybe I think there's a way of trying to approach that will actually deliver that in its best way. Why would you want to underperform? So do it being that sort of like, oh, this is wrong, you're no good, this needs to be better. Yes, that is the factually correct statement, but you've got to understand that when you use that kind of language, it has an impact. So could you frame it in a slightly different way? Could you put it in a slightly different way? So we're quite fortunate that we go through a the hiring process. We hopefully surface that before it gets into the organization. But clearly I've worked in other organizations and other areas where that doesn't quite get there. And in the military, there's a lot, you do get quite a lot of that kind of person.
Well, you've got warrant officers to straighten out people for bad behavior, right?
Yeah. But some of that is that they forget that they were, you know, on that first rung of
not the master chiefs. I mean, they're responsible for discipline up and down the hierarchy.
Yeah. And in that kind of thing, yeah, definitely there is a time and a place for, you know, shouty, get it done right now. But the longer lasting impact is that if you can deliver that in a way that's absorbed and changes behaviors or changes how people feel and gives them that extra little bit of motivation that, yeah, you know, they can do something better. And even from like, you, that's going to have a much, much more longer lasting impact. And actually in my earlier days, it's like, well, looking up, who would I want to emulate? We've all had that. You're like, oh, I remember that boss. I'd love to be, you know, he was great. And I would love to be like that person. And you would emulate that. You would try and understand that. And I've had the opportunity to go back to what were some of my early bosses and chat with them as I've had some more experience and, you know, getting some of that. Well, yeah, you know, you were a dick at that time. This is what I was trying to do for you. And it's like, yes, you will be a bit more, you know, coming out and like, I know I've done my degree or I've done whatever and I know something. You can't tell me. Well, you know, there was a really great mantra around, you know, somebody that has experience has made mistakes. Somebody that's really experienced has just made more mistakes. So, you know, we have to understand that we want people to make mistakes because that's how you learn. And I think having that type A of like, if you do something wrong, clearly they're not this environment, other environments where there's threat to life, you know, the mistakes that you make can have a very serious impact. But equally outside of that, you know, you still don't have to address it in a way that is feels quite brutal, unless that's how that you're driving that. But I think, you know, knowing that we all make mistakes, knowing that you want people to make mistakes and learn from them, then how you deal with that mistake is actually more important than the mistake itself sometimes, because that sets up the next mistake and how that's going to be. So if you rage at somebody for making a mistake, how are they going to be at the next time they make a mistake? The emotional bit of that is like, I don't want to be in that same situation again. So maybe they might not report it or they might, you know, try and push it under the carpet. But if you've gone, yeah, we've made a mistake. No, you know, we'll try and work through that. This is the measures we can help here, there. The next time it comes like, well, that wasn't a negative experience. That was an experience to learn from and to build on. And if you do that to individuals and they become managers, they'll replicate some of that because they'll want to emulate that same feeling. That's sort of, you can be shouty, but if you really want to get the best value out of it, you have to understand the impact. And if you're shouty and know the impact of it, then you're doing it consciously. But if you're doing it unconsciously, then yeah, you've not really got an understanding of that.
Or they're playing to a caricature of what they think a leader should behave like. But I mean, even in the army, I'm sure even you noticed some of your commanders were harsher than others. Some of your superiors were more forgiving than others.
Strangely, I think that happens more in the non-conf. Once you're out in a conflict zone or you're out in where you're operational, I think the demeanor is very different to then when you're sort of, you know, back in the, you know, back home doing training or building around that. You know, it's a part of that mantra of like train hard, fight easy. But people tend to get a little bit more wrapped up around that. Whereas when you're actually in an area where you're deployed operationally, yes, I think you have to be very critical and you can be critical. I mean, I've been in very long debriefs where we've been very much in the micro, but it's not personal. It's about how do we make this better? How do we manage this? And then once that's dealt with, that's it. It's dealt with. We've resolved what's needed to be done. And I think you can do that. And it works very well when there's an operational element to it. But if you haven't necessarily got that same drive, people might take a little bit more license around that, or start to believe their own bio that, you know, they are the best, you know, the best of the best, and can't be challenged, and it's their way and it's not. And it's like, well, yeah, that's not how it works. Well, for me, I think that's not how it works in the real world.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, this isn't a dig at the Israelis, but for the longest time, the view was they had the best intelligence service on Earth. And then October 7th happened. There's a saying, I think, hard work beats talent when talent stops working hard. Like if you don't put in the hours, if you don't keep up with the regular updates, as the Israelis failed to do with this case, you can be defeated by an adversary that's lesser.
Yeah, I mean that goes back to the 1%. If you're static and somebody's doing that 1% every day, at some point, no matter how high you are, somebody's then going to overtake you at some point. There's always somebody that knows a bit more, or you know, has a better understanding. So yeah, you know, you can't.
Or the tortoise and the hare, and the hare took a nap. He had a lead, and then but the claim is that hard work can overcome differences in IQ to some extent, or natural inborn ability.
Yeah, I mean, which do you want? Do you want like a really smart person that can do it, or do you want somebody that's going to keep doing it every day? You know, that's a little bit binary, but if somebody's doing it every day, at some point they can probably overtake, because that is that tortoise and the hare. But it's like, what do you need right now? And I think this is where some organizations, where they allow that toxic person to stay there because
completely.
Well, they do a great job. You know, they smash this out of the park. And it's like, well, they do, but that's one element. It's how they do it that is equally important, because that emanates through your organization, and that's what you stand for, and that's what you do. So, yeah, you could allow this, like, great performer, but or toxic be there, but yeah.
Or that someone who, say, cognitively, level of Mensa, PhD in astrophysics, your firm wanted him. He started off great. He proceeded through the ranks. He got promoted. He ended up in a senior position. And then for whatever the reason, maybe they felt they burnt out, or they felt that at that position they didn't have to expend as much effort anymore. And you saw a diminution in the value they added to the organization. And yeah, that's an example, I think, of people who are too smart living off past glories, thinking their senior positions protect them. And then you've got the young up and coming types, and they're adding more value.
Yeah.
You know, to the organization. You mentioned AI, and I don't want to close without us discussing that, at least to some extent. What is the role of AI, in your view, as a practitioner, in combating financial crime? And will it put professionals like yourself out of business? Because, I mean, some have said pretty soon it's going to be about, you know, your financial crime team in the bank. The head of that team may as well be a data scientist. It's going to be about going through troves of data, discerning patterns, and acting on them. And that's your actionable intelligence. And pretty soon, substantive knowledge of AML, KYC, CFT won't matter as much.
Bluntly, if AI could do my job, do it better, great, fantastic. If it can help combat financial crime and reduce the harms from it, great, if it will do all that. But I don't think we're at the stage where it can do all that. But I would love it to do that. Why would you not? From how I'm seeing it deployed at the moment, I think from definitely in the arena that I'm operating in, know, Gen AI can really be that additional horsepower that an MLRO or somebody working in that environment can have to help co-pilot them through, like, you know, helping solve questions around regulations or regulatory application, helping parse data and put it into something that is summarized in a way that allows you quickly to understand its relevance, or when you're talking about like false positives and other things like that from systems where you're dealing with various data points, having something like that that can collate that and summarize it into something that is immediately understandable, rather than having to then click through 10 different reports or click through, you know, bringing that together. That's got to be powerful, and that's going to help people, you know, rather than doing the, I mean, we're already having it with robotic processes. You know, if you're copying and pasting something, that's automated already. But this is then helping to bring multiple sets together in a way that you can then understand its relevance as to why it's been there. So it's one thing to, you know, have an alert triggered because of a rule. It's another to then, when it's been triggered, to bring the context of that account and maybe add some reasoning to it before the analyst even looks at it. So it's like a first tier analysis on that information, which I think having that kind of level deployed is going to help people do their jobs better. Can it get to a stage where, you know, you get into, you know, the deeper AI and machine learning? Can it get to a stage where it can make those decisions on its own? Not yet. And I'm not sure how long it would be before it would get to some of that. But, you know, you can get it to give you, in general, you get it to give you nearly all of the decisioning, but then you've got to have a human context on it because it's not quite replicated.
Right, because context matters, nuance matters. You know, Oliver Wendell Holmes said the life of the law has been experience, not logic. Because the Europeans seem to think, you know, it's because the civil code tradition, their approach to the law is a lot more formulaic. Personally, I don't think people are going to lose their jobs to AI. They're going to lose their jobs to someone who has your substantive knowledge and is a little tech savvy, and you're going to lose your job. If one does lose their job to AI, it's going to be to another human being using AI. Because a recurring theme on this program is the fundamental question of the 21st century, and I do believe this to be the case, is going to be how well does your labor complement technology? What do you bring to the table that it enhances, augments the outputs generated by technology? Do you know how to handle the technology? Do you work well with it? Does the combination of the two lead to a far better outcome? And if so, you're replacing, you know, the new world. You're replacing the table. That's why you're sitting on techies and old timers. So again, all people can learn new tricks. Going back to school and learning Python, probably the easiest programming language for non-techies to learn right out of the gate. But that's what they're doing. They're doing courses in fintech and in machine learning and AI to come up to speed. And even if they can't be techies, even if they can't be computer programmers or engineers, they're being power users. And so they're learning about the functionalities and how to deploy such technologies, which if you even grasp that, I'd say you're ahead of most compliance officers or lawyers at banks. Yes. But another point I'd like to raise with you is that of ESG, and certainly environmental, social, governance. There's more emphasis on the social and the governance. Some view it as an opportunity to reduce financial crime and crime more generally. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure if this is a recent revelation, but around the FinTech Festival here in Singapore, I was having quite a few conversations with people that are involved deeply in ESG. And it's when we talk about it currently, well, in global news, et cetera, it's very much on the E element that, you know, climate change is real and we need to do something around that. And, you know, that is you know, I don't have to say anything, that's well documented. But the other elements of ESG, so the social and governance bits, we're all thinking in that sort of narrow lane, and actually social and governance has a much wider impact. So bringing it back to what I think is, you know, really important in the you know, combating financial crime is that it's a network, you know, and actually what we do in that network is reactive. We're already right. reacting to the crime that's being committed, the illicit funds that have been generated from that's going into the system. So in any network, I would posit that if you do something upstream, it's going to then reduce what you need to do downstream in that network. So I think some of the funding right. and the focus on ESG, if you think of social and governance, means that, you know, we can look at how we get to some of the root causes to why people get involved in crime, and, you know, looking across, you know, across the world, you know, how do we combat corruption? You know, I would hate to be in a situation where I was in a place where corruption is rife, and, you know, maybe not the most affluent, and I've got to make a decision between like buying food or buying medicine, and even actually getting to do those kind of things, I've got to pay a premium yeah. to get those things. I'd hate to be in that. So if we can use ESG to work with like the UN development goals and try and reduce, you know, make sure people do have access to clean water, access to food, access to healthcare, some of the basic provisions that we enjoy and don't even think about. But if you can reduce that, it means that somebody then doesn't have to pay the corrupt official to get hold of that. And you're starting to reduce corruption. They then don't have to, I need to make some quick money, so I'm going to curry some drugs or become a money mule. They don't have to be involved in crime. And if you reduce, I'm not saying it will cure it, but I'm saying it's a way that, in this lens of looking at combating financial crime and money laundering, is that we can reduce the amount or the reasons why some people get involved in it. There's always going to be criminals that want to be that gangster and organized crime and what have you. That's human behaviors. But if you can minimize the overlap with people why good people do what would be considered bad things, if you can reduce why they get involved and it's just bad people doing bad things, then it's going to be a smaller pool that they'll be operating in. And hopefully when it comes through that network, we should get better at identifying them. But yeah, I mean, even within ESG, there's already problems around nobody really knows how to quantify it and measure the effects. So yeah, there's greenwashing and all the different types of washing that you can have within it. It's multiple countries, so it's a complex problem. I don't know if it's controversial, but even this thing around like carbon credits and like one country emitting loads of stuff, but then, you know, getting another country to plant loads of trees on their behalf. It's not quite in the spirit or the sentiment of it. So even things like that, which are legitimate mechanisms, they don't actually support what the aim of having that approach is meant to be delivering on.
Right. It doesn't solve the underlying problem because it's not a one-to-one offset.
Yeah.
It strikes me, and you're in an interesting position because you served because you wanted to. You signed up to serve because you wanted to, and you wanted to. You were looking for an adventure in life. You're living in Singapore, which still has mandatory military service at the age of 18, where young Singaporean men serve either in the military or the police force, the auxiliary services. I'm hearing increasingly that it would solve many of society's problems if young men were first forced to join the military. Of course, the attitude of the general, certainly post-Vietnam War, was it was bad for morale to have all these men who didn't want to be in. And the attitude of the Joint Chiefs in the U.S. was, if you don't want to be here, we don't want you here. Hence the move to an all-volunteer force. But then that creates a distance between those that serve and the rest of society, and where's the sense of shared sacrifice. What are your thoughts? Should every young man serve in some capacity? I mean, in much the way Germany has a public service requirement, which can be done either in the army or in a number of different ways. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a really interesting question. I think, you know, in Singapore here, you get a really strong sense of duty. But that also then...
And they're getting 2 years of free labor.
Yeah.
And then it really
focuses on, you know, national pride as well here in Singapore. And it's like, I mean, there's arguments for against. I think what military service does provide, or conscription and working through that, is maybe something that could help how people feel, or young people feel at the moment, in that there's lots of things going on that are out of their control, and that becomes anxiety, that becomes stress. And I think what military service, or a limited amount of military service, or whatever duty brings, is a degree of stress adaptation. I'm a great believer in stress as a tool for growth if it's managed correctly. And I think, you know, it goes for like strength training, but mental resilience and all these kind of things. If you do something that you believe is to be hard, and then you come out the other side of it going, well, that was hard, but, you know, I'm still here. Then the next time it happens, I mean, this is the basis of continual learning as well. The next time it happens is you're more adapted to be able to manage that. So, you know, day one, you know, I can only do one press up. Day two, one press up. Next thing you know, your body's starting to adapt and you're doing more press ups. Same with mental resilience. You know, if you're in a situation that you think, oh my God, this is so, you know, I've only got X amount of money, or I've only got this, whatever you're dealing with, the next time it happens, because you've had that experience and you've come through it, or maybe it's not it's like butter. It's not, you know, you're never stepping in the same river twice, but because you've stepped in a river before, you know what it feels like, you know what it might be. So there's certain elements of that that make you more resilient to be able to do it again. So I think doing something hard, whether it be military service or something around, you know, that level of duty where you're put in an uncomfortable situation and then you come out of it at the end, I think can help build resilience. But is it something that, you know, all countries should be doing, and it stops the wayward youth? It's the nature of us as a society that the old will always lament the young because they don't understand, they've not got the same experiences, and they're not doing it right. But those are the ones that then try to transition upwards. So, you know, it's like, is that the right mold? I don't know. But if we're going back to how I think about it, like some of the problems that we say that our young people are dealing with, and one of those is that sort of, you know, the world is too noisy, there's too much going on, how do we build resilience? Well, I think that potentially has something that could help in that. But I'm not about to say that, yeah, we should mandate across the globe, everybody should do their 2 years. But it is but if you think what that's, in Singapore's perspective, if it's not just military, but if it's like in the police or in the ambulance service or somewhere else, that is serving people.
Civil defense, yeah.
Yeah, and that is something that is really enriching. If you can see the impact that you are having on an individual and they are getting some great benefit and they're thankful, and I mean, that's an amazing feeling to have, because you realize that you have, as an individual, you have some power. And that's also a great enabler as well.
People like to compare Hong Kong to Singapore. In my view, Singapore is a far more robust, unified society, because you get a very different society when every man, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, language, or class, has to serve in the same military, and most of the manpower needs are in the army, and that's something Hong Kong can't compete with. And certainly, if you look at the impact it had on two world wars, where even the sons of the ruling class had to serve in the military in the U.S., help build a modern American nation. And in your country, I mean, it empowered the working class post-World War II, because notice, they didn't turn around and vote for Churchill again. World War II taught them, yeah, I'm as good as I'm as good as the upper middle class. I'm as good as the ruling class because I can work the same technology. I'm not stupid. I'm intelligent. You know, it empowered the working classes in addition to unifying the nation. So I do think military service would benefit many, but should it be compelled? You know, should it be forced? I'm of two minds on that. Before we close, is there anything you'd like to say, keeping in mind many of our listeners are students, though not exclusively? Is there anything you feel we didn't discuss? Is there anything you'd like to share with our audience?
I just think, you know, the age that we're living in, maybe, yeah. I don't know, if you go back and look at sages, et cetera, they're always saying that, you know, there's great developments happening. And I think the age that we're in education, that education is morphing, it's changing because of technology. But I think if you go back to the fundamentals of why you learn something and using that, I think we're in a great time to actually do more. You know, the pace of technology and what's happening is really changing really, really quickly. So you've got to be adaptable. You've got to be curious. You've got to be able to understand why. And then I think if you do that, it allows you to embrace all these different things. But don't they're all tools. They're all tools to be used. So don't think that technology and all these things will save everything. It still needs a curious mind to get the application right to be able to solve some of what the world's biggest problems. And I would love for people that are going for education now to be able to be coming out and solve what are some of these really big global challenges that we've got, which, you know, money laundering, financial crime, and actually the crime that predicates them would be a great, great one. But equally, you know, we're in an age where we've got one planet. I know that sounds really, really soft, but, you know, being able to contribute to that. And it doesn't have to be like big things. It's just the little things as an individual that you have the power to do. And everybody has that power.
It's well put. I remember David Brooks, columnist, New York Times, some years ago when he was promoting one of his books, said, learners learn. Certainly in this new age, I think an ability to learn, you know, being able to learn and learn again and, you know, absorb new material and adapt accordingly is certainly going to be most valuable. Well, Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much, AJ. It's been a real, real pleasure. I always love my conversations with you. So, yeah, let's not leave it too long till the next one.
And thank you to all of our listeners out there. Until next time.